There's such a sort of almost masochistic and heroic notion of, like, you know, you have to burn yourself out to be any good at anything. Do things that you love and get joy from that. And if you're smart, you may make a buck out of it or you may not. But at least do have a quality of life where you're actually doing stuff that you give a shit about and that you care about. And in that is the value. Kicked off as a filmmaker and was, you know, directing corporates and doing TV and ads and so on, and as a director, and pivoted into radio, where early days YouTube had been around for 5 minutes, and basically being the video guy at All Stereo. Being creative is fantastic and I love it, and that's my bread and butter and that's who I am essentially. But the bigger the idea that you have, the closer you got to be to the money. Within virtual reality and augmented reality, there's an enormous appetite and audience for training related content and education related content. And if you think of VR as being it's a very immersive experience. So 3 minutes in VR will feel like 10. So we all operate in this multi-screen environment all the time these days. But the beauty of VR is you pop on the headset and you're just totally in that environment. It means you can create a classroom and then take that classroom and put them anywhere in the world. You want to avoid thinking because you've been around that you know better. I think that you've got to remain curious and you've got to be embracing new.
Angus. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I've been looking forward to this one.
Yeah, likewise.
I think I'm not going to give away too much of your story, but it's this whole creative meets deep thinker meets entrepreneur meets CEO leader, right? So there's a bit in this one for the audience. But maybe before I start, what's excited you to be here?
Oh, look, I mean, I like what the Outperform is about. I like the idea that you're exploring not just one person's career in a simple way. You're looking at it holistically and you know, what makes these people tick. I think that's really cool. And I like the fact that you're not just looking at one particular industry or type of person. It's more like, you know, if it was a type of person, it's more born out of the kind of attributes that they have rather than the field of expertise that they might have.
Yeah, totally. So you've signed up for it, mate. Now we're going to get in on it. It should be fun. So, look, I think the Start Beyond story is really interesting, and I think, you know, XR, AR, that space will get there, you mm-hmm. know, and let's talk about that, because there'll be a lot of people that just don't even understand it on the call, even if they're entrepreneurs, even if they're, you know, business owners, business leaders. Some have had experience. We would have seen the goggles, all of that sort of stuff. But I think there's an opportunity to learn about that and see how that's emerging. But before we do that, mate, tell us about who Angus is. And I think what I'd like to go back to just from the stage in your career, you know, I think you could go back to your life and say, why did all sorts of things happen? But let's start with, you know, the kind of radio career and how life was there and what that taught you in terms of where you are today.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, basically I kicked off as a filmmaker and was, you know, directing corporates and doing TV and ads and so on, and as a director, and pivoted into radio, where early days YouTube had been around for 5 minutes, and basically being the video guy at All Stereo. So what we were doing was building out all these digital assets and, you know, working with Hamish and Andy, having musos come in. You know, we shot Lady Gaga under the stairs. All these people in this sort of infancy of a new type of media, and really sort of created the rules around how short form content would work and create an extra layer of engagement for the audience through this video content, which was really fun and really exciting. And, you know, met a whole bunch of amazing artists and had a whole bunch of adventures in the course of that. And I think the biggest thing that I learned in that was being creative is fantastic and I love it, and that's my bread and butter and that's who I am essentially. But the bigger the idea that you have, the closer you got to be to the money. And the reality was that we would have some amazing ideas, but if we couldn't work out how to connect that with wherever we thought funds could come to support it, then the idea would die. And so I learned a lot then about that if you want to execute, you can't just be thinking about the idea. You've got to be thinking about the concept around it and who's your audience and how you're going to be able to leverage that and who in turn is going to pay for it, which sounds really obvious, but actually it's a kind of a light bulb moment.
Well, it does sound obvious, but at the same time, like when you're creative, like, and this is happens with everyone emerging in their life and career, is at some point you can't just stay in your own bubble and you can come up with these fantastic ideas till the cows come home. It's got to land somewhere. And in your world, it would happen to be, you know, the radio space.
Mm.
That commercialization idea, let's just have a look at that, because there's two things what I see playing out. One is that YouTube is new,
yeah, right,
at the time. So someone's taken a bet on you.
Yeah. Right?
And the other, and that's in a space that's emerging and built, like, and to be fair, XRAR, we're probably talking about similar theme here.
Yeah.
So you've going into this new uncharted waters and you have to commercialize it.
Yeah.
You have to land the logic between interesting, creative, growing followership or audience and making money. Can you tell us a bit more about why you think the people around you made a bet on you back then?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the job interview, and I remember going in there and they'd had a whole bunch. They told me retrospectively they'd had a whole bunch of, like, you know, directors and ad guys and film directors and so on. And they said the reason why they went with me was because I turned up and I had 7 ideas and I just had them on, like, you know, a little piece of, like, I don't know, like that PVC, or I don't know what you call it, you know, the little sort of
like a card.
Yeah, a card, but like a card that was glossy and cool.
Ah, yeah.
And it just, it would have a really confronting image and then a text that was what the core idea was. And it just became a really simple way of selling the idea. So you just go bang and they'd look at it, look at the picture, look at the words and go, okay, what the hell's that about?
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. And so, and in that, what I was doing was embracing the form of going, look, we've got a new way of making stuff. And if we're going to be doing video for a radio station, all bets are off. So we've got access to these amazing talent. We've got access to a continual stream of stars. But what are we going to do with that that's going to make it be something that people will go from the theater of listening to it on air to want to go online and actually watch it? And what visual hook are we going to give that that takes it into a different space? And within that, radio is really long form and it's very personality led. So if you're going to do video, make it short form, make it like, you know, like just 2 minutes and just have all the cool stuff right at the start. Now, at the time, no one was doing this. Like, you know, now we've got TikTok. We actually did the ridiculously short film festival with Hamish and Andy. We had Jeffrey Rush as the judge. And the ridiculously short film festival was movies that could only be 7 seconds. So, you know, and this is back in, like, you know, sort of, I think we were doing that in 2009, 2010, something like that.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah, it was ridiculous and it was great. And some of the stuff that people came up with was superb. So, yeah, I mean, it's about playing with form and it's about form not only in the interview process but then actually in the job itself.
And are you the sort of person that's good at taking people on the journey with risk?
Yeah.
Because you'd have to be.
Yeah.
So because there's, you know, there's that idea that, okay, you know, that old saying, you've got a head for radio. These people would have been at the time thinking differently. So talk us about how you took them on that journey of transforming from, you know, into this short film idea, why that was, even back to that, you know, back then, it was 2016, 17.
Yeah, that was by the time I'd wrapped up. By then, 2016, yeah. I'm off in VR, AR land.
Yeah.
I know it's so long ago. We're talking like 2008 through to 16.
Yeah, so 2008, immature market.
Yeah.
Take us through, sort of help us understand how people responded to these new ideas at that time.
Well, I mean, I think the way that it's the same strategy that I would use now as I used then, which is basically you've got to listen to the person and understand what it is that they want to get out of this idea. Like, why would they, you know, and there's always going to be people who are innovators and there's also going to be old mate who just doesn't want to do it. And so it's always about encouraging the innovators and then unpacking why the curmudgeons aren't wanting to play and diving down into where their fears sit and why their reluctance, and then breaking that down in such a way that then they're like, okay, well, I'll give you a crack. But you only get them on the journey if you get them to buy in. If you just isolate and keep the naysayers out of the picture, it'll never land. But if you bring the naysayers with you, then you got a chance of actually and then they become your biggest advocates. Because then when it works, They're like, oh, look at me. Wasn't I clever? I backed this kid.
So, yeah. I could see that. And sometimes I do that myself now. I'm the old guy. So, Angus, maybe to help the audience get a feel for that, right? Because I think this creative juice is something we're going to squeeze out today, and other people might be able to take a bit of that juice. But
yeah.
What was a genuine practical example of where that was a big win? There was a moment of truth where you're like, oh, I got him. I really landed that creative idea. The money landed, and then we played with it, and the audience came. Like, what was something that really landed back then?
Well, we did a piece. So I can't believe I'm telling this story. Okay, so a mate of mine, who in fact years later he and I started Start Beyond, Kane. But Kane and I would do this ridiculous thing over Christmas. You know, you're watching the cricket, Richie Beno's still on, and we do our ridiculous and incredibly bad Richie Beno impersonations. But we wouldn't do Richie talking. Instead, we would do him singing a song, like, you know, like singing the Star Wars soundtrack, for example, okay, or the thing like bah, 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 bah. And so bah, bah, bah. And so anyhow, so I thought, okay, there's something in this. And so we pitched that. Well, I pitched to all the guys at Triple M who were receptive to innovation, but also still, like, you know, some of them are pretty old school 80s, 90s, all killer, no filler, Aussie rock kind of head space. Yeah. So, and I pitched to them, show us your Richie. And the idea was that people would be able to, and the thing about it was that you had the visual of them impersonating Richie Beno or doing whatever, but you also had really strong sound so that then it could work on air. And so it became a thing where people would upload or submit their Richie Beno in whatever form. We knew by doing that we could hook into the commercials around, you know, at the time Triple M was, you know, a lot of it was around sport. So we knew that we were hitting the target demos there. We then were able to make it national. So all the different states and all the different radio stations could do their own version of it, but it'd still be a national play. So we could then get national sponsorship. And so then that became an idea that we were able to roll out, and yeah, it absolutely hummed. It was great. It was great content. It was great engagement. The client was really happy, and everyone sort of looked at it and went, wow, okay, so there is a way to take something that's visual and sound and make it hum. Yeah.
So that recipe would have been rolled out a few times, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, I mean, with any good idea, there's variations that they're involved.
You do know, I as a consumer, I notice it. But so that's good. So Richie is a winner, did you feel that put you on the map at the time, or was that part of really lifting your brand in the space?
I think that when that played out, there'd been other. See, the difference in, like, if you come from like a TV or film background or, you know, advertising or whatever, the director calls the shots and is the creative. And so I went in there all guns blazing with that sort of mentality. And then I realized in radio, like the presenters, the on-air talent, they are essentially, they're the ones on the firing line. So it's all their personality. It's all who they are. And because they're on for so long, there's no performative element to it. It is who they are. That's what makes them so good. They're authentic. Yeah. And, you know, if you're doing, you know, 3 hours of content a day, then you can't fake that stuff. So what I learned, and I learned through just, you know, going in and pitching something and it not landing and going, well, why didn't land? That was strong, was that director mentality wasn't going to work in that space. It wasn't about me being the one in charge. It was about me feeding ideas that then the talent could take, because essentially the talent was the director. And whereas traditionally in you know, film, TV and so on, the producer is someone who's really shaping the show. In radio, the producer is more there to facilitate what the talent want to do and to be able to guide that or make it easier or what have you. So more logistics, and good producers have creative elements to their role, and they'll drop in an idea and then they'll let the talent run with it. And that's what I learned. Like, if I wanted to get stuff up, it wasn't me going, hey, here's a great idea. It was more me going, hey, have you thought about, you know, Richie Beno? I mean, what a great voice, yada yada. And you seed it that way.
Yeah, interesting. So that shift to an influencer of others along the way.
Yeah, just like, you know, there's no point having a good idea if you can't get people's buy-in. So the best way to get people's buy-in is to make them think it was their idea.
It's a challenge for a lot of creatives.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there will be creatives listening to this who are sincerely passionate about their idea. And even that creative idea might be launching a business, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It is about making it someone else's idea. It's about having that consumer buy in and believe.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you look at it on a business perspective, like, okay, it's a great idea to have an idea for what your business should be, but ultimately, your idea of the business isn't the point. It's whoever your customer is wanting that and wanting that idea, and they have to own that idea. So, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. I think you've got to be able to make sure that you don't have an ego that blocks whatever your business idea is or your creative idea from being embraced and taken by someone else and them running with it.
Mm. Yeah, totally. But it's easy to have that ego, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, totally.
So obviously that moment of shift and you know, I want to move on to Start Beyond in a moment, but I want to kind of understand a little bit more about how you transformed as a leader. Right? Mm. So that moment of understanding who you need to be in that environment without losing that authenticity, you know, was the ego jolted at that time or was it a... you know, was there a moment where you had to look in the mirror? Well, like how did you go through an evolution as both an influencer in that environment and also a leader in that
industry? Yeah, it's a good question. I remember I had a meeting with Hamish and Andy and their producer, Sam, and all of them, like really lovely guys and really talented and really authentic. And it was early on in my career at Austereo, and I went down there and I was excited about meeting them and, you know, I was, you know, admiring of their abilities and so on. And I went in and I pitched all these ideas and I said, yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah, yeah, that's great. And we're really nice and really polite. And I left going, wow, none of that's going to fly. And they were really nice about it, but every yes was clearly a no. And it meant, and I found it kind of like, okay, well, why didn't I get that right? What did I do wrong? And that was a real turning point. That was when I learned, okay, like if I have to understand what these guys are about and I have to understand how they like to operate and get into their groove rather than try to take my stuff and
plant it on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they did it in the most, you know, lovely and charming and not fake way. Like, you know. And
they weren't trying to offend you or anything like that.
They were just being like, you know, and then, you know, I don't know, 18 months later, we're in the outback of rural Queensland and we're pushing a car out of a plane.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Drop the bomb. Yeah. Yeah.
So $100,000 or something. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and that was that arc of going from that point to then being part of that campaign and, you know, having 13 cameras and we're shooting it at 10 in the morning and by 5 p.m. that night, it's up and down the east coast of Australia. We've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of views of the content already and that kind of thing, shooting it all in a caravan in the middle of Whoop Whoop. And just seeing that whole thing play, that was a great sort of arc, I guess.
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, it's fun. Yeah. And they're so talented, those two. Yeah. And Sam as well.
What makes them, like, I'll go back to you in a minute, but just on Hamish and Andy, because you clearly admire them. What makes them so talented in your opinion?
Well, okay, so... the thing, Andy is always up for it. He's just like, yes, okay? Like, he's just boundless energy like a Labrador, just bounds out and what have you got? And he's ready to go. And Hamish always looks at something and sees the obvious gag and then ignores it and goes for something totally different. And it's that freshness that it just, like, it's startling to watch and it's an absolute delight. Like, case in point with the drop the bomb, I've got the video camera out. We're in the middle of the paddock. There's a massive hole where the car has crashed and landed in this dirt thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, so Hamish, can we do something about like how big the hole is and all the rest? And start rolling. And then he goes, geez, these binoculars aren't very good. I don't know how we won the war with these. The bombs, it was just perfect. Yeah. Like, yeah.
So he plays with the less obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I was like, damn.
And that is what keeps the audience engaged, right? It's that surprise and delight of the whole, the way the humor flows out. Mm. It's such a skill. So if we kind of go back to yourself in this, because the idea that I'm noticing and I think we'll draw out of today's discussion is a lot of people are consciously incubating an idea and building it out. Now, if I look at your story and you can tell us a bit more about the time of radio, then we can talk to Start Beyond now. Is that all of this is measurable as well? You know, you grew audience, you grew, you know, on key metrics, you were winning and you succeeded, you built team out. What
when you, before you talk about Start Beyond, what did you, what have you learned about incubating an idea and building out results? So let's go move away from the creative to the more commercial side of your head. What have you learned about that that's now setting you up for success in the XR/AR space?
Well, I think the first thing is that whenever you're dealing with a client and they want to know the results, then invariably what happens is people are scared to say what they want the results to be because they feel like if they don't hit whatever that mark is, then they'll be marked against it. And people are apprehensive about being either under or overly ambitious. And how do you navigate that? So what happens is a lot of folks don't want to say what their specific measurable results are going to be because they don't want to get marked against it. So how you navigate that is you have to have an extremely clear objective and you have to have an extremely clear purpose. And then every step of the way, you mark the team and yourself against like a filter. Like, you know, are we hitting, this was our core objective. This was our core purpose. This is our core audience. Are we hitting those marks? And if you consistently reference back to that, then the success will come. If you lose focus on any of those three, you won't be able to hit what you want to achieve.
So tell us a little bit more about that in terms of that fear of the result, right? So you're talking about purpose. We're clear on particular, let's call it lead indicators along the way that mm-hmm. tell us we're getting there. Mm. Are you afraid of the result, or do you find that it's more of other parties? Have you been more of the ambitious type that says we can climb that mountain and we can grow the audience by this percentage? Like, how does your mind think when you think about growing an idea or growing a result?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, to be clear, I'm not scared of results. I'm not scared of whether I fail or succeed. Like that, it doesn't. That to me. Is kind of like it's not important. I know it sounds absurd, but if you fixate on the results, you'll bugger it up, guaranteed. You have to fixate on the much more fundamental layer, which is purpose, objective, audience, in my mind.
The controllables.
Yeah, yeah, because if you get that stuff right, the rest of it will happen. And I think as a leader, part of what you've got to do is if, you know, and it's true across every facet of life, like things never end. You know, until you're dead. And even then they don't really end because you're going to live on in how you're seen by the rest of the world until the people that you love are dead too. And then eventually, you know.
It dissipates.
It dissipates, yeah. But so, I mean, with that in mind, like the point is how do you present your idea or your soul or your, you know, project or business or whatever? How do you present it in a way that enriches the lives of those around you? And in doing that, you've got the win.
Mm. So just staying in the purpose space as much as you can. So let's look at your business now. So you're the CEO now. You set this up with co-founders. You've been building it over time. It is a new space.
Mm.
So what was the purpose that you, when you sat down as a team at the start, you said, what's the purpose? Why are we here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a really, you know, when we kicked off Start Beyond, we basically weren't aligned. And it held the business back for years. And, you know, I learned a lot from that. So I came in, like my best friend Kane, he set it up and he and I were going to build it together. And I was at Nova by this stage and we were going to do a Nova Red Room with Ed Sheeran and we're going to make it 360. And I couldn't jump ship and start working at Start because I had two kids and a mortgage and I wasn't, you know, my wife's an independent film producer. Like, it was too risky. So what we did was we went down this path of doing this Nova Red Room. We're going to build that out. And then in the course of that, the deal fell through. But Kane, by that stage, had enough of the business in place that then I could jump ship and 6 months later join Start, what was then called Start VR and now Start Beyond. But in that 6 months, he got two other co-founders. And those co-founders wanted something different. And what we had from 2016 to 2019 was this business that was split in two different ways. We were doing entertainment VR and we were doing commercial VR. And separate to that, we also had this platform with the idea being that the platform would deliver to all. What that meant was that we never had that single clear purpose. And as a result, our energy was divided. And as a result, we didn't get as far as fast as we could have. We did amazing entertainment work and we did amazing commercial work and won a bunch of awards in both. But as a business, we weren't cohesive.
So that's, we're focused, that whole idea of focus and prioritization and in your purpose is so important.
Yeah.
And at the time, there can be a lot of fear driving that. Mm. I was actually having a conversation with a startup the other day and we weren't working with them as a client, but they said, oh, we'd love your advice. Can you work with us? And I said, what do you do? What's the point of your, they got seven different offerings.
Yeah. Wow.
It's like, wow. Like yeah. I've been there. It burns you.
Yeah.
You burn money, you burn energy, you burn time, you burn client experience, you burn a lot of things. Now obviously two, services underpinned by a common platform is probably not that complex. But where were all the losses coming from when you think back?
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, tell me more. Just more specifically.
Yeah. Okay. Well, basically the entertainment stuff, we didn't make any money.
That's good.
That's interesting. it was brilliant and it was, it cost a fortune, looked incredible, won of a bunch of awards, but the reality is that consumers weren't prepared to pay for it. There wasn't a business there.
What's an example of an entertainment solution that you guys created?
So the TV show Wentworth. So basically we made a VR version of that and we won like a Screen Producers Award for it. It's the best interactive piece. It's amazing. You go in it, you got Pia Miranda as your like your jail buddy, and you've got to try and survive your first couple of nights in jail. And we used the Wentworth set. It was a collaboration with Fremantle Media. It was amazing. Yeah, it was super cool. And it cost like $5 to get it on, download it from the App Store and be able to play it in VR, or you could watch it on your mobile phone, et cetera. Didn't make a cent.
Well, because I'd imagine there's a lot of capital and upfront cost that goes into coming out with these ideas.
And I mean, it was a content marketing play as well, so it was good for Fremantle and what they wanted to do in terms of, they have super fans and so on. So it wasn't like it was a fiasco, but... and it was a prestige play and all that sort of business. So it did well, but it just, if you Start Beyond could not make a business born out of that kind of,
Unless something really kicks in, which makes it a lot more risky, right?
Yeah. But even in that regard, in terms of what we know about the market within VR, that kind of content is not where the VR market is. And we kind of knew that at the time, but we were hoping that we could create a different consumer within that market, and then it quickly became apparent that that wasn't the case, and then it just became a matter of navigating the politics of those founders who'd wanted to do something that wasn't a viable business and making those choices, which thankfully they did, and now we're humming.
One of my old mentors said to me years ago, Brad, feed a hungry audience, don't try and make them hungry. So who are you? Who's your hungry audience at the moment? Tell me about that.
Yeah, okay, cool. All right, well, first, just on that, the two things I want to just throw in is like when you're talking before about being spread out, my favorite phrase in that regard is strategy is choosing what not to do. And fish where the fish are. So they might,
Well, that's the point about strategy, isn't it? There's so many alternatives and ways you can do things.
Yeah.
With the constrained resources, what are we going to do and what are we not doing?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's such a smart way to look at it. So what are you focused on? That's all right.
So I mean, basically within virtual reality and augmented reality, there's an enormous appetite and audience for training related content and education related content. And if you think of VR as being, it's a very immersive experience. So 3 minutes in VR will feel like 10. So we all operate in this multi-screen environment all the time these days. But the beauty of VR is you pop on the headset and you're just totally in that environment. So it means that it's extremely immersive. And it means that you can transport the user from whatever situation they are into whatever the VR world is. So that means you can create a classroom and then take that classroom and put them anywhere in the world in doing any kind of scenario. And so immersive learning through scenario-based experiences is really powerful. And it means that if you're in VR and you've got someone looking straight at you, you feel like they're talking directly to you and there's nowhere else in the world to go. So you really engage with that visceral experience, which means that you can create emotional intelligence. You can create the capacity to have people start to see the world differently, to feel empathy, and also to be able to visualize concepts that otherwise would be hard to understand. So speed to proficiency becomes easier because you can actually see how you're supposed to do the task and then be able to do it. So whereas from a consumer-led, you know, people are, you know, there's a lot of noise around like, you know, is VR hype or not? And the thing is, from a consumer-led perspective, there's a target audience there where they'll play first-person shooter games in VR and they'll love it. But for the rest of the world, the beauty of VR is as a learner. And if you're, you know, most learning is boring and most training is dull. And if you're able to take VR, you actually supercharge that and allow people to actually experience something in a far more effective way. So you get through more content faster and you have them remember it.
I was able to meta the other day and I got the chance to play around with some of these learning solutions. What's your, just for the audience's sake, that's, it's good to understand a practical example. What's your favorite example of a learning solution that you've seen or been part of?
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many that we've done that I'm super proud of. So, there's a lot. Okay, so there's a lot more aggressive customers. Like across the board, people are, as frontline workers, confronted by aggressive behavior. And the offshoot of that is how do you instill in your workforce resilience? And how do you navigate this? How do you de-escalate situations? How do you stop, you know, something going from bad to worse, but actually make it bad to good? And so we've built out a bunch of different VR scenarios whereby we help with that. And the way that it works is you will have like the aggressive customer like eyeballing you. And then depending on what response you give will then help de-escalate that situation. And the principles behind that can work not only in aggressive customers, but we've built it out for aged care workers. So they've got like, you know, dementia patients who are getting really agitated. And then depending on how you respond, that you'll calm them down. We've also done it with young adults who are neurodivergent or autistic. And they've got like, you know, complex situations happening, which are everyday life, and they get to do a trial run without the emotional risk. And so you get to have a crack at going on a first date and saying all the wrong things and getting totally burnt so that then you understand what an appropriate behavior is so that then when you're out in real life, you can actually navigate it and actually have better social connections with folks. So they're the kind of things that get me excited because you actually see a tangible shift in the way that people see themselves in the world and also how they connect with others. And, you know, in the case of like, you know, Claire Nolan and the fact that cop bloody tasered her and killed her when she had dementia in the nursing home last year. Like that's the kind of thing by us building out this dementia care piece, it meant that it wasn't just the nurses who were putting on the goggles and understanding how to de-escalate these situations, but the hospitals were actually using it with their security guards and with the folks who do all the catering and actually going, look, you know, when you're dealing with the guy in room 8 and he's a grumpy old curmudgeon because he's got dementia, chuck on the goggles and now you'll understand why if you say this, it's going to make him more agitated. And so it improves the level of care people get without having to resort to violence and without having to resort to drugs to dope these people up. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel strongly about it. Yeah.
I'm massive on it because, you know, from a learning and development perspective, there is a bit of a bias to presenting people with knowledge or information.
Mm.
And even what we're doing now is doing that. You know, we're just having a conversation. Someone's listening to the other side and they're getting it and then they're having to interpret it and then they're having to do something with it. So we're removing this layer, we're improving the interpretation stage, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah, it's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
And I think that's so powerful. I mean, I put the goggles on the other day. I was having a conversation to this avatar and it was like, I think it was about how empathetic I was or something. There was some measure of it, but it was just a bit of a test drive just to go through the experience. And I can see what you're saying in terms of that immersion and how I can rapidly then understand and get really quick feedback on how well I'm doing.
Mm.
So when you look at these customers that you've got of all different industries and types, it sounds like there's quite a few industries you guys work with.
Mm.
What are they often asked? Like obviously, they're looking for, you know, a shift in understanding or learning, but what's the, why are they taking the risk to go to VR? Why are they getting confidence with it?
So like what you find, like there's principles behind it that work and this is why we work with so many different industries. So the beauty of VR is that it allows you to visualize these things. So it means that you can then have speed to proficiency. So you can, you know, for example, you know, we're working with Woolies, and the way that that works is that we've built out a whole bunch of different scenarios so that new employees can pop on the headset and discover how they're supposed to, like, you know, either engage in customer service or understand the ripeness of an avocado. If you've got the VR goggles on, you can see that stuff. Then you immediately understand it. You don't have challenges of whether English is a first language or not. You don't have to translate a 2D image or slide and text into understanding what that means when you're out on the floor. Because you chuck on the goggles, you're out on the floor.
You're out on the floor.
Yeah. And then, as you say, it's not a passive learning experience. It's an active one where you're choosing things and you're seeing when you choose them what happens and whether it works or not. So a lot of clients come to us going, look, you know, we've got training that we know is click and flick and it's e-learning or it's 2D, and we know that people aren't really engaging with it, but we don't know what to do to be able to reignite their engagement. It might be compliance related stuff. It could be customer service, or it could be things like, you know, fatigue based around, you know, customer behavior causing low morale. And so there's ways to unlock all of those within the VR space.
I get the sense there's a lot of focus on safety as well.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, there's a duty of care that employers feel or have, both compliance and also because everyone wants to be an employer of choice. So you need to be able to then show that you have the, you know, commitment to that, and the quality of the training is reflective of that. So, you know, and it also gets used in industries where, you know, for example, we built out a piece for shearing because the shearing association was like, oh, we have all these kids turn up. They want to become a shearer and they don't realize it's hard work. And so they just see the pay packet of 130K a year and they're like, damn, I want to be a shearer. And so they turn up at the farm and then they do a day's work and they're like, damn, this is hard work, and they're out of here. And so what we did was we built a VR piece whereby you chuck on the goggles and you have to deal with shearing a sheep and you see what it's like. And then it meant that the shearing association saved a bucket load of cash because only the kids who really wanted to do it, having seen it, went to the next stage.
Ah, so it creates that stage gate. And yeah, I can imagine wrangling a sheep. I had a crack at it years ago. I went to a boarding school in a mate's house once. It's hard work.
It is hard work, yeah. I tried it and they told me to stay behind the camera. I was hopeless.
That's awesome. Is this space also migrating into customer experience as well? So what I'm assuming is probably happening or starting to happen is, you know, I might have a design of my new house and I can now have a proper virtual walk through the place that I'm about to invest lots and lots of money into, or we're about to change a design of some precinct or whatever it might be. Is that space also occurring?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything where you're, I mean, like we did a piece for Gold Coast real estate developers, and basically we built an apartment in VR that actually, and we went and shot drone footage. So we took the drone, got 30 stories up, and then shot what the view would be at that point, 30 stories up, and then integrated that view into the CG version of the apartment that we built, so that when the developers were selling off the plan, they could have their clients pop on the headset and actually see what the view would be from the living room. Yeah, it was great. It was heaps of fun. Yeah, so anyhow, and we've kind of been focusing on VR, but I just also wanted to add, like with AR, the way that AR works is that it allows you to visualize concepts and see under the hood. And so, you know, if VR is you chuck on the headsets and all you can see is what's inside the headset, the beauty of AR is that it supplements your environment with additional information. So when you've got, you know, off the back of COVID and we have all these QR codes, everyone's familiar now with the QR code, and that can then work as a marker to then enhance whatever assets you've already got, whether they be print or digital assets, and actually have a 3D model of that related content in the space with you.
Okay. So I think I can interpret that. I have had the experience with something like this. So it's like, yeah, I could see you in front of me.
Yep.
And the artificial, or the piece that you're trying to introduce to me, can now sit between us.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I can interact with it, but it's not real.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or, okay, so we've got the microphone here. So what we could do is create an AR of the microphone, where basically you use your phone and you're looking at, you can see the microphone, but then you can have visualization, or like 3D graphics of, okay, the way this microphone works is that this little part's doing this little thing, and if you press this, you'll break that, and visualize the inner workings of the microphone. And then you can see it in real world.
You see it in the real world, again, yeah, in your environment. So you can see how big it is and how it fits in and how I'm Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And open it up, and you know, so it works really well for trades because that way you're able to actually see the equipment and understand how it works. So, you know, if you're in the field and you've got this piece of equipment, you don't know why it's not working, you can use the AR to be a 3D model and a guide to say, have you checked these parts and look at it that way. So it supplements you real well.
Yeah, brilliant. Mm. So to me, like, I'm reasonably excited about all these things. I get interested in them, but how mature is the market?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. There's been a lot of hype. It goes through all these hype cycles. You know, Facebook calling itself Meta was a massive own goal, and these kind of things. So the maturity in the market is twofold. There's a whole bunch of organizations that are right down the path and doing it really well. And then there's a whole bunch of organizations who are kind of like thinking, I don't know, is it still where it used to be 8 years ago? You know, I did VR once where I popped on the goggles and I was in a roller coaster and made me feel sick. You know, it's like, and it's just, it's kind of like the same way there's bad films and good films. You know, there's some stunning VR that's incredibly effective. And then there's bucket loads of bollocks as well. So, you know, you got to be discerning.
Yeah. It comes with any new market, doesn't it? Yeah. It comes with any market, like even if it's matured, you're still going to have good, bad and ugly, aren't you?
Yeah, totally.
So let's switch gears a little bit. So, you know, obviously this space is really interesting. You're leading a team in this space. Mm-hmm. I can imagine building out a team, you probably needed to find a very unique skill set. I'd imagine. I'm not sure how many people are used to coding up and developing this type of solution, let alone understanding the problem, let alone getting around the whole, you know, the nature of all the dynamics at play. It sounds really sophisticated.
Mm.
What's it been like building this team?
It's been absolutely fascinating. It's been really rewarding. And the team that we have at Start Beyond at the moment, I'm absolutely just so enamored with how all the different skill sets and personalities and just the general vibe of it all. It's really, really satisfying. I think the reason why Start Beyond succeeded was because we had, from the outset, we had different skill sets. So my background's creative storytelling, and then, you know, the commercial ins and outs that I've learned to bring to that storytelling. Then you've got people who are just super technical. So Jager, our CTO, is just part mad scientist, you know, an amazing guy. And so he's building out the app development side of things. But then you've got Joseph and Isabella who have headed up the asset creation and then the management of the teams. And so within that, you've kind of got three different things. You've got the commercial, you've got the creative, and you've got the technical. And those three groups come together really well to be able to then build out what is Start Beyond.
So it's a superpower team. Everyone's got their strength. And you need that in that diverse type of solution.
Mm.
What's it look like practically? Where do you guys do really well? And where do you find sometimes there's a few headaches?
So I think where we do really well, we're in this little sweet spot at the moment. Like things are humming right now. So when things weren't doing as well, where we were making the mistakes was more people doesn't mean faster work. Throwing people at it doesn't mean you get it done more. Or faster. It just means that you've spent more money trying to get it done.
You set it up properly, right?
Yeah. But even then, like to set it up properly, you have to do it. You have to be smart in that incremental growth. Like, you know, otherwise you're going to churn. So, this is just my opinion, but like, you know, we had more people doing less, you know, 4 years ago. We've got less people doing so much more now, because we got really clear about what the roles are and how within those roles we could cross-pollinate different skill sets to be able to get the most value out of that position, but then also to have someone who was really challenged in that position and being able to use all of their skills rather than just be pigeonholed into one small part of that production process.
So it makes it a more desirable role for the right person.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're getting more productivity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm assuming people have been through that journey. What was it? What's it feel? What did it? Was there feedback coming, or was it your observation? What did you notice?
Well, all of the above. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, there was the core team at Start Beyond has been there since the outset. So, you know, over 8 years, and Isabella, for example, she came fresh out of uni, and she's still with us. So, you know, and she's now 28. So, someone of that caliber and intellect and skills, you've got to keep challenging them, and you've got to keep expanding their role, and you've got to keep sort of learning what is it that that makes them tick and what resonates with them and their work-life balance and all that sort of things. If, you know, because the hardest thing to find is talent, you know, and if you find talented people, you just want to do whatever it is to be able to keep them engaged and committed to the business, you know. I mean, case in point, Michaela, one of our devs, she finished high school. She finished uni. I hired her when she was 17. Yeah. She was like 6 months younger than my son who was still finishing the HSC. She'd already finished uni and was getting her first job at the age of 17. She finished high school, I think, at the age of 13, something ridiculous.
That's unbelievable. Like,
yeah, she's a smart little cat. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, she's stunning. So, yeah, it's about talent and nurturing them.
And and everyone on the, anyone listening to this knows that, right?
Mm.
What have you learned the most about retention and building a great team? What's been the secret sauce for you?
Being honest, just being straight up. Like, you know, there's no point saying everything's perfect when it's not, and being able to have, like, one of the things actually, so the beauty of like working at Austereo and then at Nova and working in those big organizations was that, you know, and particularly at Austereo, I got support and training around management related skills. And I learned stuff in that that was not just observational of me doing my job well or badly, but actually, like, here's some core skills that you can learn.
Yes.
And kind of like a trade or a craft, you're like, you learn this.
You learn management, you learn leadership, yeah.
Yeah, and you can just take that and then bring it. So I've really tried to bring what I learned there into our business. And, you know, in particular, one thing that I found really powerful is having a working agreement. And it's like, you know, just sitting down with someone and saying, because everyone makes assumptions about what's appropriate or inappropriate behavior in the workplace, you know? And if you have a working agreement, then it allows you to be able to go, look, you know, we agreed to, like, for example, there was one guy at Austereo who every meeting, it didn't matter when I had the meeting, he'd always be eating. He'd always be eating some goddamn salad or something.
He must be hungry all the time.
Oh my God, it drove me absolutely spare. So I'd try to arrange a meeting at 10 o'clock. He'd be having some bloody thing. 3 o'clock, it didn't matter when. So I had to sit down and have a working agreement with him because I just got sick to death of watching him shovel stuff into his mouth. And it's the same thing, whether it be something trivial like that or whether it be something really important, such as how you're behaving born out of when you're under duress. You know, and so if you've got a working agreement there that both parties talk through and agree on in times of when they're in sync, then when there's times of pressure, you've got a reference point to come back to and go, okay, we agreed on this. Like, I know you're under duress or I'm under duress and I'm calling out my own behavior or I'm calling out your behavior. We both agreed to this. And that's born out of respect and trust. And so then it helps people go, yeah, okay, fair call. Recalibrate, take the heat out of the room and be able to then, you know, build and continue to build a strong, you know, working relationship.
Such a good framework. The and it's interesting, I say to a lot of people that, you know, that rules and clarity for some feel, you know, in terms of introducing it, feels like it's they're putting a burden on someone. But that's actually very liberating for you, but it's also liberating for them. They understand, they're clear on what they're, you know, what can I expect from Angus? What can I expect of myself with Angus or the others in my department? Is that between you and everyone, or is that every, like, is there a sort of company-wide kind of agreed?
There's from a company perspective, I think that the way that I've approached it is more cultural of just going, okay, like, you know, if you have flexibility in the work. You have to get the work done. And if you're not going to be available at this time, you've got to be transparent about why. And we work through that. I don't like a mentality of clock watching, but because I want people to just care about the work and just want to turn up and do the work and be proud of the work. So you don't want to create that. However, you need to also say we're having, you know, a stand-up meeting at 9:15. So naturally, if you want to be on top of your work for that day, then, you know, that meeting will be happening whether you're here or not. And so that allows people to then manage it and navigate it that way. In terms of the working agreement, I mean, like, I find with particular people that I'm working very closely with that I will write that and we'll together build that out, you know, because one of the things that I recognize in myself is that if I don't, like, I can very easily just prioritize something else and then be running late for someone else. And I don't, you know, I don't want to do that because I don't like what that signal is that it sends. So part of the working agreement is I say, if I've got a meeting with you at this time, I will be there. And I commit to being totally focused on whatever we've agreed to discuss. Yeah. Because I think, particularly if you're a leader, if you can't give that very strong signal to your entire team that their time is equally as important as yours, then you're tripping up.
Totally. Yeah. It's it's sending a signal around respect. But the other thing I think it sends is this idea that it sounds like you're cultivating, which is that there's a degree of discipline that comes with flexibility.
Yeah, yeah. You responsibility, know, they come autonomy. Hand in hand. Yeah,
yeah.
It's respect and, you know, do the work and respect yourself and others and, yeah, things will hum.
Yeah, no, I think in this world that sort of maturity is required and, you know, you tend to hire well and you try not to let that in your culture, but if it's in there, you get it out pretty quick.
Mm.
We're going to change gears a little bit, Angus, because I think there's a part of your story we haven't touched on yet and well, there's quite a few parts. There's lots of your story. We could talk about family. We could talk about all sorts of things, but you're an author.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's I'm not going to steal your thunder, but a really interesting concept that you wrote about. And I'd love you to talk about that. And I'd love to hear about how that's entwined in who Angus is as a CEO and as an individual and how that fits into your life. But tell us a bit about the book first.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, so the book's called Viewer Discretion Advised, and it is a work of fiction. And it really, the basic premise of it is a guy who runs a VR company. So, you know,
sounds familiar.
You can see it's like, you know, a big stretch so far. He's coming back from a work gig and he's at the airport and he's bored and he downloads this app and the app allows him to be the leading character in his favorite films. And then all of a sudden he's like in his favorite movies and he's the main role and he can be like the action hero. He can be the leading man. He can be whatever. And he's like, oh my God, this is the greatest app ever. And then he tries to get out and he can't.
He's stuck in the virtual land.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And it goes from there.
Now there's so much in that. So why write it in the first place? Just talk me through this.
I wrote it because I really, really, really wanted to. It was self-expression. It was being able to explore all these different things that, you know, I think we all go through in life and be able to unpack all these really complex themes around masculinity, but do it in a way that was something that I like. I just wanted to write a book that I knew my friends would love, you know, and I just basically, you know, like a bunch of mates, yeah, early days at Start Beyond, like Ready Player One came out and all these guys, like I did Inglid at uni and all these blokes that I've known for, you know, 20, 30 years, whatever, they never read. And all of a sudden, you know, everyone's reading Ready Player One. I was like, okay, damn. So there are like guys my age will read. It just has to be a book that they give a shit about.
Be interesting.
Yeah. So I very much, you know, coming back to the whole purpose thing, I had a purpose. I knew the story I wanted to tell and I had an audience. I knew exactly who my readership was and who I wanted to write it for and who I wanted to have relate to it and feel it.
So it's your mates.
Yeah.
Or people like your mates.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah.
Who are they? Tell me about, like, what does that person look like in your head?
Well, I think that person looks like any guy and any woman who's loved a guy who really wasn't sure what the hell his role was. Like, what the hell am I doing? Like, how did I get here? Why isn't me packing the goddamn boot of the car? Like what how did I come to this point? And navigating that sense of self. Like how do you wrestle your ideas of what you thought your life would be when you're a little kid and the heroic notion that you had of what you might be when you're 12 years old with the 30 something human being that you are now and the commitments and so on that comes with that.
It's an absolute wrestle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm talking to lots of friends at the moment. They're in a bit of slump.
Yeah.
You know, I've just turned 40. I'm saw people that I know a lot of our demographic are that sort of 30s, 40s age. And you wake up in the morning and you say, oh, is that how it works?
Yeah.
Is this all I'm going to have? And, you know, there's this whole expression of what we should be in the world that you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Absolutely. And using film as the launch pad to explore that and using the whole notion of masculinity and movies that we love and the cartoonish representation of both men and women in film and that is the touch point to then build
the,
out
the role
that
you're meant to play.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, are you the action hero? Are you the rom-com lead? You know, every rom-com guy in those movies has a smoking hot wife. Like, how does that work? Like, Jim Carrey's got this incredibly stunning, you know, woman who's like 15, 20 years younger than him. Like, come on, mate. I mean, this is bollocks. So, you know, it's exploring these unrealistic expectations that we have of ourselves and of our lives in a fun way to then unpack what's really worthwhile.
What's worthwhile? What's the most unrealistic expectation that you hear a lot of either your friends or even yourself that you've that's maybe an expectation but a belief system that you believe came from our era, the upbringing,
exceptionalism.
Yeah,
we're all supposed to be exceptional.
Yeah, interesting.
We're all supposed to be, you know, and I think, like, you know, from an entrepreneur thing, like, fail fast and, you know, like, work harder and churn. I just think that that's, you know, There's such a sort of almost masochistic and heroic notion of, like, you know, you have to burn yourself out to be any good at anything. I just think that's rubbish.
Yeah, the whole hustle hard.
Yeah, hustle mentality. Hard, like side hustles. Like, do things that you love and get joy from that. And if you're smart, you may make a buck out of it or you may not. But at least do have a quality of life where you're actually doing stuff that you give a shit about and that you care about. And in that is the value.
Well, it's interesting because the exceptionalism piece that you're talking about, like, people listening to this will go, well, that's all right for you, Angus. Look at you. You've written a book. You're a CEO of an amazing startup. You're dealing with some of the most impressive technology that the world has had experience with so far. You're exceptional. It's okay for you to say that.
Oh, man, exceptional is all relative. I mean, Jesus, I look at so many people and go, oh, my God, how did they get to that point? Like, no, I don't think, I mean, yeah, so both everyone's exceptional and no one's exceptional. You know, I mean, that's the reality of it. We're just all here for X amount of time and just, yeah, you've just got to be honest with yourself.
But, what's been one of the moments of either your professional career, leadership, you know, just it, or life where you've had to be honest with yourself?
Oh, I mean, I think there's so many different examples that spring to mind to that. I think one moment that really galvanized for me that I needed to do that was I'd had this thing where basically, like, I was on a hang glider and the guy didn't attach me. So we took off at Byron Bay and he didn't attach my hang glider. So I fell the distance of two Byron Bay lighthouses onto the ground. And everyone thought I'd be dead. My wife was pregnant with our second child. And the Ambos were there. They thought I'd be dead. The whole, yeah, song and dance. And the thing that saved me was that on the way, like, I saw my whole life flash before me. I'm holding on, like, my hands just holding onto the thing, going, oh my God, I'm gonna, like. And the thing that saved me was that I just thought, I've just got to let go. Like, I can't control this life. I can't control anything, and I've just got to let go and just accept. And in doing that, I know it sounds highfalutin, but it's true. It's just 100% true. And my mind was racing, and I remember there was this guy at uni who had been so drunk he'd fallen three stories, and because he was so drunk, he just landed like a rag doll, and he'd survived that. So in this whole sort of hyper state of letting go, I just let go of consciousness and my life, and just went, "All right, it's been great." Yeah. Which I know sounds bizarre, but that's what happened. So I land and I survive, obviously, and everyone's like stunned. And I spend a week in this hospital up near Byron, and every other guy in that ward was over 70. And basically, if they were leaving that ward, they'd be coming back soon enough, and they're at the end of their lives. And I was 32. And I remember none of those blokes talked about work. All they talked about was their family and the people they loved, or the regret they had about work and the fact that they did too much of it. And it was a really, like, it's just like, you know, it was a privilege to be in that room and to have those four guys talking, because it just unlocked the whole world to me. I thought, I've got a second chance, and I'm not going to fuck it up by not knowing what the true value of life is.
Man, that's a beautiful story.
I didn't expect to tell you that, truth be told.
No, no.
I don't, it's not common knowledge.
No, I can see you're pretty emotional about it too,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I can see that would have been a huge stage of your life. The, and it's interesting because as you were saying it, I was going back to your previous comment, which is on the commercial side, and I was like, that's what that whole results thing is. It's like let go and do good work. Just do good things. Be a good person.
It's pretty simple.
Do your best.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So, yeah, so anyhow, viewer discretion advice. It's a good book. You should read it.
Yeah. There's no falling out. That's a long way.
It was a long way. Yeah, there's like, you know, because it was back in the day where there's still newspapers. So, like, you know, the headline was Tourist Falls This Far and Survives. And it was like two Byron Bay lighthouses on the front page as the graphic. Yeah, happened on my birthday.
On your birthday too. Yeah, yeah. So was it a gift for your birthday?
Yeah, I was like, okay, I've always loved kites and I've always wanted to be able to fly. Bugger it, I'll go hang gliding. Whew. Yeah.
Just a little bit more practical. What were the actual injuries?
It was pretty amazing. Basically my back was so swollen that for about 16 hours or so, they thought that I was a quadriplegic because I couldn't feel my feet. I couldn't feel any of my lower body. And, you know, Sammy, my wife, she was like, you know, pregnant with our daughter, had a 18-month-old little baby boy and was thinking, wow, I'm going to be managing a quadriplegic for the rest of my life. Like, it was intense. As it turned out, because I sort of fainted on the way down, like I had a few like cracked ribs and that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Oh, wow. I'm glad you're here. <That's true. laughs> you can tell the story and learn from it. And I think there's so much in what you just shared around just that simplicity of letting go. So really powerful. Mate, what excites you about the future? Where's Angus, if we sit here in 5 years' time, where's Angus going to be?
Oh, look, I mean, I'm excited about the future because of a bunch of different reasons. But fundamentally, I think it's... like to your point before about, oh, it'd be easy to say that because, you know, you've done all these things. It's kind of like I'm at an age now whereby I'm excited by the prospect of just being expansive. I've, you know, like you talk about turning 40 and when you've got kids and you're navigating all of the responsibilities of fatherhood and running a business and having your own ambitions and goals and so on. Once you get to a certain age, and your kids are old enough and you've nurtured and supported them and they're feeling independent, then there's this terrific unlocking of that relationship. And it's like on a simple level, like I'm going to be playing cricket with my son on the weekend and, you know, father-son cricket. Like, you know, when he was 14, he stopped playing cricket. He was like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Played basketball, skated. He's now 19 and... I don't know. I think it was to do with Dave Warner retiring. He suddenly was like, yeah, I'm really into cricket these days, Dad. I want to get back and start playing with you. I was like, yeah, sure. And so I'm excited about the future, about the fact that like having invested this time and energy both in the business and my family and friends and so on, that now there's this greater freedom of being able to see that flourish and not having to be in the weeds about it so much, but more just enjoy the relationships and success that's been born out of really nurturing that.
The time with people in a you know, like as a father, there's this point where it's like we got to get to school or you've got the task to do or the thing that needs to become the taxi to get them to sport or whatever. But that deeper connection, which, you know, it's interesting. I really try my best to have that deeper connection where I can today because I know that, you know, it'll look different later on as well.
Totally.
Being able to play cricket at the moment, you've still got the body for it. And you can handle a day out there.
How's
the shoulder after?
Yeah. Look, I mean, like my son, because I bowl off spin that doesn't turn, but I do all the posturing of it's going to like rip like a foot and a half. And I stand at the end twisting and throwing the ball up and the batsman's like, oh, I wonder where this one's going to go. And all I try to bowl is Yorkers every single time as off spinners, but act like they're going to turn
a mile.
That trick
doesn't work after a few.
You'd think. But if you keep the theatre up, then yeah. So it's like, and then finally, when if I'm lucky enough and they get out, they always go, oh, it was the straight one that got me. It's like, yeah, mate, they're all straight.
So you guys enjoy that on the weekend now?
Yeah, it's great fun. Yeah, so I play, I mean, basically I'm the oldest guy in the cricket team and then the youngest guy in the soccer team. And I find doing that is just a great way to, I don't know, stay alive.
Do you see sport as a creative pursuit?
I think that sport is definitely creative. I think that it's an absolute joy. And I think you've got to have something that, you know, there's so many things that get the endorphins going that aren't healthy. So it's great to be able to have some that are. And I love the camaraderie of a team sport. I love the fact that you have totally different personality types and totally different, you know, folks from totally different backgrounds and thinking and so on. And they all come together for this common love, this one simple task of either getting a ball in the back of the net or sending it to the boundary. And yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And then talking about it for a few hours afterwards all the things that happened along the way.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. I should read your book. I think we're on similar vein. mate, and final question, what do you want to avoid in the next 5 years? If we sit down in 5 years and go, I just really want to avoid this. Is this something I want to stay away from?
Oh, look, I think you want to avoid thinking because you've been around that you know better. I think you've got to remain curious and you've got to be embracing new all the time. I think that, you know, part of the reason why I hadn't played soccer since I was six, and then I joined when I was in my mid-40s because I played rugby as a kid, but hadn't played soccer. And I joined because I wanted to do something where I wasn't the expert. You know, if you run a business and you're the guy who's like, do it this way, blah, blah, then you forget that capacity to learn. And so by going and playing soccer where I was absolutely hopeless with these old Greeks and Italians who'd yell at me and call me a Malacca and all this sort of stuff, it meant that I got that refresh of not being the one who knows how to do it. And it meant that I was able to do my job better because I knew what it was like to be the learner rather than the expert. And so in 5 years' time, I want to still be the learner.
Mm-hmm. Keep putting yourself in learning positions.
Yeah, yeah. And just, you know, just because you did it this way before doesn't mean that's the right way.
Well, I hope you've learned a few more tricks for the next chat.
Yeah, me too.
Well, you might need a new sport or something. No more hang gliding, please.
No. Yeah, I'm not going to be hang gliding anytime soon, that's for sure.
Angus, it's been a pleasure, mate. I mean, we could talk forever, and I'm sure there's so much we could explore around XR and AR, and we could talk about your life, your philosophy, your book. We could go deeper in a lot of areas. But if someone wants to get in touch with you and talk about anything that you've put on the table today, how can they do that?
I reckon the easiest way is just reach out via LinkedIn or, you know, startbeyond.co is the website. But yeah, I think LinkedIn's the best way to go.
Well, mate, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and I'm sure other people will too, mate. So thank you.
No, my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it too. It's been great. Thanks.
Cheers.